From the top in solidarity, this pod was recorded during the 2023 WGA and SAG after strikes. Without the labor of the writers and actors currently on strike, movies being discussed in this episode wouldn't exist.
What I love about Mission Impossible, those films understand that you kind of want to see Tom Cruise look a little ridiculous. He prevails and he does awesome things, but so many of the set pieces in these films rely on this slapstick, everything has gone wrong, he looks like an idiot, and now he has to find some ridiculous way out of this predicament.
You're listening to the Bright Wall Dark Room podcast, where we belly up with critics, artists, and our magazine's contributors to speak from the heart about film. I'm Veronica Fitzpatrick.
And I'm Chad Perman.
Chad, how's it going?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm okay. Yeah, mostly well, too. Definitely feeling the kind of back to school depression.
Oh, are we already at that time?
Yeah.
How soon is back to the teaching?
You know, it's not even, for me, blessedly, it's not even that soon. It's like a month away. But I think once we hit August and once it starts getting dark again around like 8 p.m., it feels like it's all over.
Feels like it's time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So summer's over for you. You're done.
Summer's over.
Okay.
It's over. How about you? How are you?
I'm doing good. I'm post-vacation now, so I'm on the other side of the big thing for the summer. And now it's... But the kids, they start school before Labor Day, and this will be the first year they're both in high school. So I'm not needed anymore in like 3 weeks. It's like parenting over.
Congrats.
Yeah. Going to drive each other to school. Well, one will drive the other, the one who's...
Wow.
It's like you know, all that from the kindergarten drop off to now. It's that arc is over.
Amazing.
Yeah. But the cool part is that they're way more into movies now than they used to be when they were in kindergarten. So you get to watch a lot more movies with them, and that's a great experience.
I love how that's the cool part, even though you're describing like a massive logistical benefit to them getting older. And
well, there's lots of, you know, my daughter has a job and yeah, she's driving all over, you know, she's pretty much a grown up. And then, and now my son just last week, which he will tell you about if he comes into the room, is past me in height. So he's taller than me now.
Wow. So, and how tall are you?
6'7".
Come on.
5'10", the exact height of the average American male.
Oh.
I said that last part because my wife always says I'm short, so.
Oh, my God.
I did look it up.
Cruel.
He is 14, and he got to 5'11", so he's on his way up.
That's sick.
Towards the land of the six-footers. Yeah, it's awesome.
Oh, my gosh.
I always wanted to be 6 foot because, you know, my basketball career was cut short by just not growing more, which you can't do anything about. So.
Yeah, you and Kate Moss. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. It's our curse.
How tall is your wife?
Yeah, great question.
This is what I want to know.
She is 5'7" and a quarter, okay. I think. Yeah. And we do have one grandparent who's over 6 foot. So my son, Elliot, has a chance of getting over 6 foot, which has always been my dream.
It's overrated, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. But there's not a lot of us Permans that ever climb the 6 foot mountain. So if he can get there, I'd be proud of him. He does hang from the ceiling every night, and we're working with him to stretch out. So
wow,
not
okay.
Really. But we didn't talk about the weather, so that's good.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
It steps in the right direction. We're getting more interesting every single episode.
Yeah, we're really nailing this pre-show talk.
Yeah.
Do you want to get into the films? Because I don't want to waste time on not talking about the films with today's guest.
Totally.
We got such a good guest to talk about some great movies.
Let's introduce our guest.
Okay. Well, so as a film critic, Ilga Abiri has appeared in essentially every major outlet. He was lead film critic at The Village Voice from 2016 to 2018, currently writes for New York Magazine and Vulture, where his review of Dead Reckoning Part 1, one of today's films, attributes the allure of the Mission Impossible franchise to the way these films, quote, feel like magic tricks built as they are on anticipation, familiarity, misdirection, and spectacle. So here to break down the magic with us, welcome Ilga.
Hello there. Good to be here.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome.
A very casual intro, yes.
That's what I always say.
Hey.
I never know what to say.
How'd I end up on a podcast?
Well, you know, not the first time it's happened, but yeah.
This month even. I told them before the show, I listened to your Oppenheimer one from Cows in the Field. Oh, cool. I just want to check in because I know you'd seen Oppenheimer 7 times at that point. Have you seen it 8 yet?
I have not seen it 8 times. As I mentioned on there, a good chunk of those viewings were during the month of June when I was working on this piece. I will say,
yeah,
2 days ago, more tickets became available at the IMAX 70 millimeter in New York, and I did buy more tickets just to make sure I can see it at least one more time in IMAX 70 before it leaves. Yeah. Well, because it's like so few theaters have that.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're being very good about continuing to program it, but at some point it's going to run up against, you know, a film that has that screen booked, and then who knows when you get to see it.
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, anyway, fascinating conversation that everyone should check out on that podcast as well. So anyway, but today we're here to talk about Mission Impossibles.
Missions Impossible.
Missions Impossible. Yeah.
Missions Impossibles. And we will kind of jump around maybe through some of them, but the main ones we're focusing on are the last two, Fallout, and then, well, this summer's actually Dead Reckoning Part 1. Mm-hmm. I think we have a synopsis to kind of get us going, and then we will launch into the Mission Impossible universe.
Perfect.
MCU, right? No, MIU. The MIU.
The Missions Impossible. So Mission Impossible, for those listening who are maybe like slightly less familiar with the franchise than everyone on this call,
obsessed, yeah.
Which is everyone, begins with Bruce Geller's CBS TV series, which ran from 1966 to 1973. It rebooted briefly on ABC in 1988 and was finally brought to the big screen in 1996. The Impossible Missions Force, or the IMF, is an ensemble of covert government agents who use force, manipulation, and particularly disguise, among other means of espionage, to work on secret behalf of mostly the U.S. government. Agent Ethan Hunt, played by Tom Cruise, leads a crack team of specialists on potentially fatal operations under the guise of volunteering their expertise for the greater good. And then meanwhile, throughout the franchise, Hunt falls for a series of relatively interchangeable large-eyed brunette women while defending the lives of various citizens, yes, but mainly the lives of his chosen family. So these are films about friendship and nostalgia, as well as pyrotechnics and stunt work, where death is courted as often as it is defied.
And just a quick heads up to our listeners, though I'm sure the more hardcore among you are going to be aware that this is kind of always the case, but we're pretty likely going to be getting into some pretty serious plot spoilers for the original Mission Impossible film, as well as for Fallout and the brand new one, Dead Reckoning Part 1.
Bilga, I am so excited to talk about the franchise with you, and I would love to hear just a little bit about your relationship to it, maybe leading up to the release of Fallout and then looking through this most recent iteration, Dead Reckoning Part 1.
I saw the first one when it came out in theaters. I think I saw it like opening day. I mean, I love the film and I loved it, and I was a big fan of Brian De Palma, but I wasn't like a huge Tom Cruise fan back then. And, you know, some people will remember, I mean, Tom Cruise back then was, you know, obviously a very successful actor, one of the biggest actors on the planet, the biggest actor on the planet. But, you know, critics always had kind of a love-hate relationship with him. I wasn't a critic at the time. I was, you know, I just graduated from college. But, you know, I had sort of absorbed the critical sort of pointy-head skepticism about Tom Cruise. He was the guy who was in like big studio star-driven movies that were sometimes good, rarely great. You know, you sort of begrudgingly admitted it when he was good. He was kind of, he was just a little too.
The Firm was solid. The Firm was a solid film.
I'm not the biggest fan of The Firm, but you know, the thing is, I have since had various changes of heart on Mr. Cruise. But the thing that I remember about him, and you know, I've written a lot about him over the years, and I've written a lot about the Mission Impossible films. But, you know, Tom Cruise was the guy who had the great smile. He all, you know, his characters were always kind of very driven, very all-American, if you will. And he kind of embodied that sort of very Reaganite sort of go-getter 80s ethos. And I think that's one of the reasons why critics didn't quite know what to make of him, because he was sort of, you know, he was a little suspect in that sense. But he, you know, but the films he made,
he wanted it too bad.
He wanted it too bad, like. But he got it. Like, he kept getting it and he wanted it. He didn't play it cool at all. And so you always kind of wanted to see him just like taken down a peg. What I love about the first Mission Impossible, and I think, you know, the other films have also done this, is that I think those films understand that you kind of want to see Tom Cruise look a little ridiculous. Like so many of the set pieces in these films rely on this kind of almost slapstick. I mean, yes, he prevails and he does awesome things, but so much of it is everything has gone wrong. He looks like an idiot and now he has to find some ridiculous way out of this predicament. And, you know, I mean, the Langley break-in sequence is a classic example of that. I mean, what makes that scene is Tom Cruise just kind of flailing, you know, 3 inches above the floor. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, at the end of all of these, he must triumph, and that's okay. So yeah, this desire to kind of see Tom Cruise humiliated a little bit. Like the Mission Impossible films, ironically enough, probably traffic in that idea way more than a lot of the more mainstream films he's done. Now, over the years, I've really come around on him. I mean, quite aside from the fact that the film industry has changed and, you know, movies like A Few Good Men, which back then we were like, okay, I guess it's fine, are like, you know, yeah. would be like the greatest thing ever today. I mean, I watch that movie like once a week. Not once a week, like once a year, I watch A Few Good Men because I enjoy it so much.
Once a week would be incredible.
But I saw A Few Good Men when it came out and I was only kind of, you know, meh on it at the time.
Yeah, me too, in the theater.
Yeah, you know, we're snobs.
Yeah.
Little did we know. But I have over the years, going back over Tom Cruise's filmography, I have really come to respect the kind of quality control that he exerted over so many of these movies. Very few of them are like just lousy. Like very few of them are movies that he has no business being in, you know, I've also just having read up on the production histories of so many of these films, like he actually, I mean, starting with Top Gun, he really exerts creative control over a lot of them as well. Very often he brings in his own screenwriters to sort of do polishes on the whole film, but also his character specifically. So a lot of the Tom Cruise persona comes from Cruise himself. So I think that's, you know, it makes it fascinating and also makes this series fascinating because this was the one where I think this was the first time he produced one, right? And it was kind of like, this was his baby.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so interesting to think about how his persona has changed and been reflected differently throughout the series. And I just rewatched the first film this morning and it's so funny to see him as the kind of like, how old is he? I think I took a note about this.
33.
Well, his character is supposed to be 31.
Ah.
Because he's supposed to be born in 64, which would make Ethan Hunt 59 now, which is just wild to think about. But at 31, he's this like cocky, gum-snapping upstart compared to the like dignified, trench-coated John Voight character. And then now to see the franchise kind of, and I guess by the franchise, I also mean Tom Cruise himself, the performer, kind of understand people's desire to see him faltering or experiencing like fatigue or lapses in competency or whatever it is. And it's something that we see in the Maverick movie also. And then like Edge of Tomorrow, I think makes really great use of the same kind of thing.
Both McQuarrie penned.
I know. It's like McQuarrie. Yeah. I feel like, does McQuarrie like low-key hate Tom Cruise, even though Tom Cruise has made him like a billionaire? Because he keeps creating these roles where there's some kind of level of, as you were saying, almost like silent film level humiliation to the sort of action sequences, even if they ultimately sort of end up virtuosic and successful.
Yeah, he's got like basically a 61-year-old out there on top of a train trying to be Buster Keaton. It's a recipe for something going pretty
doing pretty good though.
I know, and I know Fran wrote about this a few years ago, but watching those behind the scenes features on the stunts, it really is like, oh no, we're one day going to wake up and it's going to say Tom Cruise died on the set. Like, how does that not happen at some point? Like with what he's doing and his increasing age, but also just what he's doing. I mean, I couldn't have ridden a motorcycle off a cliff at any age in my life. And the intensity too, like that's got to fade with age, doesn't it? Or does he just like burn out then disappears into the ether?
I hate saying this, but as I was watching Fallout again, I was like, I think he might actually have a death wish.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's what Fran's piece was called. Yeah, the death wish. Just because of him driving around on the motorcycle in Fallout. Yeah. She was like, I'm just terrified that whole time.
I love Fran's stuff, so I should read that piece. But we don't need to get into all his personal stuff. But like over the years, we've gotten these little glimpses of it. Mm-hmm. In so many ways, it's a sad life, you know? Like,
it's a tragedy.
You know, there's tragedy. I mean, he's also like, I think he, you know, can't really see his kids that much. I mean, there are all these like weird things about his life. I mean, I don't know how much of it is true. Like there's very little that's been confirmed. And everyone I know who's worked with him has nothing but wonderful things to say about him as just like a colleague and a producer and a creative person. Mm-hmm. But, you know, right now what's happening with Mission Impossible, part one and part two still shooting, it's become like a Synecdoche, New York type situation. This thing is just going and going and going.
I love that.
And we don't know when it's going to end. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a part of him that doesn't want it to end because that's where he is totally in control and totally himself and totally sort of at the top of his game and also looked up to. Whereas if he's out there just like living his life or having a girlfriend or something like, or starting a family, like then just like the speculation starts and everything spreads and it just becomes this corrosive force. Whereas if he's out there just doing stunts, people love it. Nobody's out there saying, you know, here's what's problematic about Tom Cruise, you know, jumping a cliff in Norway. The second he goes home, those takes start, you know?
That's a really great point, yeah.
He's in this ideal state. The question is, how long can it continue?
Yeah, that's, and we all get to watch how that plays out.
Which is exactly what's happening to Ethan Hunt at the IMF. He just refuses to walk away, right? He has every opportunity, more or less, to be happy, at least with one woman, but really with a couple of them over the course of the franchise, and can't do it because there's some kind of more, a sense of a more noble calling, which I think totally applies to how Tom Cruise seems to, or at least how people even write about the way Tom Cruise approaches his work as like a savior of cinema.
Yeah.
It's interesting how that first film, you know, they did shoot a sex scene that they cut from the film.
Oh,
and
really?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And or I can't remember if they, I think they shot it and they cut it.
Brian De Palma cut a sex scene.
Oh, yeah. Well, Tom Cruise cut a sex scene.
Oh, yeah.
And to be fair, I could be remembering wrong. It might be that they'd written one but never shot it. I think they did shoot it and then cut it. You don't miss it. I mean, I mean, it's kind of implied in the movie. But I think just by not having that scene, it changes the whole trajectory of the series and his character and his character's relationships. I mean, it's what, talk about sort of a fateful decision.
Yeah.
It gives you an idea of how he was originally conceived and how he has transformed over the years.
Totally. I have to imagine that the scene you're describing happens or would have happened in the film after there's this like very enigmatic fade to black after Emmanuel Bayard is kind of like making out with his hand.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
And that's it. And I just remember watching it this morning and being like, what? Like, what? It's such a strange kind of ellipsis in films that are typically sort of obsessed with not only showing you everything, but usually showing you sort of at least twice, like once as they describe how they'll break into Langley and then once when we see them doing it.
Sometimes they'll describe how they did it afterwards too, so you get the
totally
trifecta.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a really mysterious moment, but at least with the costuming, that first Mission Impossible is decidedly sexier, I think, than what we see in the later entries in the franchise. I love seeing the De Palma fingerprint in like a pair of stockings that's visible in like the first couple of shots or something. Pretty different.
Yeah.
It is, although I still maintain, and the headline to the to my review of Fallout was Mission Impossible Fallout is sex.
What do you mean by that?
Watching it again, I mean, it's weirdly horny movie, but never overtly horny. Like, if you have a dirty mind, that movie will drive you crazy. You know, I mean, there are certain scenes where like where it plays into that idea, but like the bathroom fight and all that. I mean, there's a lot of that.
Love Leon Rose.
There's the chemistry between, you know, Tom Cruise and Rebecca Ferguson, obviously, but then
off the charts.
But then there's, you know, between him and Henry Cavill. I mean, there is so much sexual tension between them.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think I'm like crazy reading that into there. Like, I think that's there. I genuinely think that's there. I mean, they're playing it up because I think that makes it more fun. Right. I don't think they're like trying to like queer the franchise or anything like that. I think they just kind of think like this kind of back and forth. It's like sort of, you know, even something like Michael Mann's Heat has that kind of energy. Right.
Sure.
You know, so there's so many films that play on that idea. I think filmmakers are pretty savvy to that.
Oh, yes. 100%. As a fellow critic who put Heat on their top 10 list, I absolutely agree. One of the most romantic movies ever made.
Was that on Bilga's?
Yeah,
That was on your list?
Is.
Okay. Yeah, no, Veronica's has been always saying she put that on her list, but
there's
I didn't know
like
there was
four
someone
of
else.
Us.
All right.
Who are US-based.
I'm shocked there's only four. I was convinced that Heat would make a good showing this year, last year.
Yeah, from the US. I think it's a slightly better like global showing, but yeah, that's such a good call. I mean, I remember that headline and thinking like, yeah, that's it. I mean, not only is Fallout like so replete with all this weird chemistry and Vanessa Kirby too.
Yeah, she's great.
Just, she's so good and she's so good at kind of doing what Vanessa Redgrave, I think, was doing with Max in the original film, that even to the cadences and everything. But also like, what a beautiful film. I just thought Fallout was, you know, and a lot of the more recent films are quite aesthetically pleasing, but makes all these compositional and sort of color palette decisions that are really, really memorable. And that is maybe where my dissatisfaction with Dead Reckoning Part One begins, is just what seems to me like just a really steep decline in terms of style and aesthetics. I don't know. Bilge, tell me what you think that film looks and sounds like, because I know that you wrote a positive review that I really agreed with, honestly. Like, it really resonates with how I saw the film too. I think my expectations personally as a spectator were so high after Fallout, because I thought that movie was like perfect, basically. Mm-hmm. And it really exceeded my expectations, even as a like fervent appreciator of the franchise. I mean, I cried watching the trailer for Dead Reckoning, if that tells you anything. And then I was like, oh no, every aesthetic moment is in the trailer and there's nothing left.
And
for
has
the
a
film.
Behind the scenes featurette on it as well.
I do like Dead Reckoning a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I know what you mean in this sense. There is a lyricism to Fallout that, you know, watching it again, I was reminded about, which also connects to the first one.
Yeah,
I like all these movies. I don't like Mission Impossible 2, but there's so many things in Mission Impossible 2 that are worth liking and celebrating. And also, I mean, talk about lyrical, romantic. I mean, it goes over the top with it, right?
The doves.
Yeah, and I remember seeing that one in the theater too. Yeah, like starting the movie with him hanging off the cliff in the theater was just, that was an amazing moment in my movie going life.
Fallout is the film that comes closest to connecting to that De Palma quality. You know, not just in the sort of romantic chemistry idea, but also, like, for example, I'm always taken by how beautiful this scene is when they're talking about how to get Solomon Lane out of the truck. The White Widow and her brother approach them and say, okay, this is the thing. And then he kind of has this vision of how it's going to go. Now, at this point, we don't know that this is a vision or kind of a hypothetical thing that we're watching. We think it's actually happening. It's all silent and there's this kind of mournful music playing. I mean, it's like something out of a Sergio Leone movie. It's beautiful. You get wrapped up in what's happening. And then it stops and you realize, you know, he's saying, no, we can't do it that way. And it snaps back. So it doesn't become part of the narrative, so to speak. It just becomes like this weird little stylistic moment. Dead Reckoning has that too. Like Dead Reckoning also has a scene where they're like, okay, how are we going to do it? And then you cut to them doing it and then suddenly it stops and they're like, wait, no, this isn't going to work. Mm-hmm. It's very well done. So I can't really knock it. I enjoyed it when they did it, but it doesn't have the weird sort of poetic quality of the first, which comes out of nowhere in some ways. I mean, it doesn't have to have that poetic quality. It just feels like a flourish. It just feels like this weird directorial flourish. And the music is kind of beautiful and everything. And I love stuff like that. And Fallout has a lot of stuff like that. I mean, all the films kind of have little moments like that. Dead Reckoning weirdly doesn't, even though it actually has some very emotional moments, like when, you know, Ilse Faust is killed. You know, it's a little more literal minded in that sense. But at the same time, I wonder if some of that has to do with the fact that it's more of a complete movie than a lot of other sort of part one movies that we've gotten recently. Like there's a couple where I'm like, whoa, that's it? That's the movie? Wait, it was just getting interesting. Why did it stop?
Is that Dune?
Dune, I was like,
Barbie.
Hour of Dune, I was just like, oh my God, I feel like I'm just watching like doors and walls and things, ships docking. And then it starts to get interesting and then it's over. And I'm like, oh, look, Javier Bardem is here. Like, oh, hey, like now we're cooking with gas. I don't love that. I did not love Dune, but what a great ad for Dune 2. Yeah.
Totally.
I can't wait to see Dune 2.
That's the featurette at the beginning. Yeah.
So I didn't have that problem with Dead Reckoning. I felt fully satisfied.
I was worried about that going in, where the cliff was going to be hanging at.
Especially like since this is the one that says part one. I mean, that was the thing about, that was the thing about, the Fast Furious, Fast X, whatever the hell it was called. It was like so not a movie. Yeah. And then like it didn't even have an ending. And I was just like, come on, it's just, this movie's sorry, can I don't know, can I use profanity on the podcast?
You
like,
can.
This movie's just like a series of fuck yous to the audience, you know? Again, I did not have that problem with Dead Reckoning, but I do wonder if some of the things we sense were missing in Dead Reckoning. I wonder if that has to do with the fact that like we haven't fully seen the whole thing. That said, I also know how they make these things. They're like rewriting them constantly, so who knows, you know?
Yeah, I mean, they might get to the set and change the whole plot on the day, you know? I mean, they famously do lots of different swerves. Like,
yeah.
The thing that didn't, because I felt the same as Veronica. I mean, Veronica, I spent years talking about our excitement for this movie, so kind of setting it up to fail in a way. But rewatching Fallout last night, what I really noticed, because I was like, okay, I liked Dead Reckoning, and I do wonder, hey, if I just saw this as a standalone movie out of nowhere, would I think it's great? And I think probably I would.
Right.
What I felt was missing from Dead Reckoning Part 1 was the emotional stakes that came from, like, the glimpses of his wife in Fallout. For, like, mm-hmm. I could not emotionally connect to Tom Cruise and anything he was going through. And I know that's not the point of these movies, but I couldn't get there in Dead Reckoning in the same way. And I think I didn't care that I couldn't get there in Ghost Protocol or the other ones because I hadn't been shown what it's like when you can get that in there. Like, mm-hmm. I thought that he handled the emotionality so well. And also that they didn't play him and, like, Elsa into, like, this weird love triangle with his wife. Like, his wife was happily married to randomly Wes Bentley, and they were off having their best life, like, being doctors and around the world, Doctors Without Borders or something like that. I really love how they handled that. Like, that's a really tricky thing to both know that, like, this is the woman that he, in whatever way he's capable of, like, loves and wants to be alive more than anything, but him being near her jeopardizes her. So they do that so subtly, but also so well, and it undergirds kind of the whole film. It's, like, there once she's introduced. As opposed to Dead Reckoning, like, I laughed out loud in the theater during the flashback scene when they were showing, when they invented this whole new reason why Tom Cruise actually joined the IMF, like, seven movies in, and they didn't even really, like, try to make it look that great. Like, it looked really, like, I think it was in someone's review, like, it just looks like they put a wig on one of the guys and just kind of dyed the other guy's hair, and they're like, here it is. And this is the whole reason for everything. And we'd never even heard of
Marie. Yeah.
Like, that was a brand new character who died right away.
And did anybody think that was Hayley Atwell for a second? Like, she kind of looked like her, I thought. I don't know. Maybe it's just the whole big-eyed brunette thing.
I do think there's this whole, he tries to make them all look the same. But it was weird.
Yeah. It's like that Black Swan effect where every woman in the franchise looks the same.
They use that flashback to then add on to a story they just developed, which is that everyone he gets close to as a female or has feelings for dies, which, as Nicholas pointed out in his essay that we actually just published today, that's not even true. It's not even a true thing, let alone this other woman getting thrown. So it was just, I didn't like what they were trying. I could see the work, and I didn't like seeing that they were trying to manipulate me emotionally, whereas I felt pleasantly and happily emotionally manipulated in Fallout. Every month on Bright Wall Dark Room, we belly up with critics, artists, and contributors to speak from the heart about film, which got us thinking, what if we had a space like that every day of the week? A space where artists can go off script on love for their craft.
Introducing Gallery, a new cinema club built by today's most celebrated filmmakers. Helmed by Indian Paintbrush, the folks who brought you the Grand Budapest Hotel and the Asteroid City, Gallery combines personal film collections, thoughtful essays, and live experiences into a single destination. Built by artists as a response and alternative to binge culture, Gallery is not a streaming service. It's all human, no algorithm. A communal cinema experience that celebrates the nuances so often missing in today's industry. And Brightwall Dark Room listeners are invited to receive early access before its official public launch.
Gallery is shaped by many filmmakers that we love here at Brightwall Dark Room, including Mike Mills, Karen Kusama, Ed Lachman, Taylor Russell, Ethan Hawke, and Maggie Gyllenhaal. Members will enjoy access to these artists' hand-picked film libraries, as well as original videos, audio stories, in-depth articles, and exclusive live events. Because, like Bright Wall Dark Room, Gallery is a community that believes movies are better experienced together. And just a quick heads up, we actually do have our first live date scheduled. Veronica and I will be talking about the movie Daisies from Mike Mills' list on Gallery's platform on Friday, August 25th at 1 p.m. Pacific Time and 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So we'd love to have you join us.
To join the club, go to www.join.gallery.com/BWDR. That's GALERIE.com/BWDR. This idea of, like, the mournful flash forward scene in Fallout that Bilge, you were just describing, which also I love that too. And there's a lot of moments in Fallout like that, that just have, as you were saying, this kind of, like, mournful quality and a lyricism, and they're kind of in excess of what the plot necessarily needs to get across, like, events and cause and effect. My favorite action films, like Heat, like Speed, I'm going to talk about Speed.
All right.
Just, like, at least have that in play quite a bit, where there are these weirdly beautiful, like more beautiful than the film necessarily deserves or something.
The fire's going off on the telephone.
Totally. Oh, yeah. Fire in the telephone front. I love that. The fire is calling. I'm totally crazy about a like mise-en-scene moment like that. Mm. And yeah, it is exactly that that I found missing in Dead Reckoning. And I know people are ascribing the canted angle close-ups to a kind of De Palma like throwback, but you're the first person I've heard say that it's really Fallout that is kind of the inheritor of De Palma's stylistic fingerprint. And I think that totally makes sense to me, that the excess and the kind of the flourishes are there, and you get a sense of authorship. And weirdly, because the author is the same here, but I feel no sense of authorship from anybody really in Dead Reckoning Part One.
That is interesting. Yeah.
I think that's something I was missing.
I think maybe visually, this is the first one I believe they shot digitally, right? As I understand it.
Yeah, that's right.
I did not find Dead Reckoning visually flat or anything like that. Mm. I enjoyed the more immediate quality of it. I mean, I love Fallout's more composed quality, but there's room for, you know, it's not shaky cam, it's not green grass, but it does kind of have that slightly more sort of close quarters quality. I mean, that was actually a thing that, you know, with Indiana Jones and The Dial of Destiny, which is another film I enjoy. I enjoyed Dead Reckoning more, but I do like Dial of Destiny. But that was another thing with Dial of Destiny where I remember watching and thinking, I mean, it's an Indiana Jones movie and I'm enjoying it, but it's not shot like the other Indiana Jones movies. And I think a lot of people sort of reacted negatively to that, which is understandable. Mm-hmm. I mean, Dead Reckoning, I think for the type of story it is and for the type of sequences it's got, I think works really well. It doesn't pause as much as the other movies do. I mean, it really is a little more relentless in its set pieces. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably also because they got more time to fill. They don't have a lot of time to kill, but a lot of time to fill. But it does also want you to pay attention to its plot a bit more.
Yes.
Right? This is the thing about Fallout that I love. And I don't know that this was intentional, but like, I mean, I've seen Fallout so many times. If you asked me to summarize Fallout, I couldn't fucking tell you what the general story itself is.
Yeah.
Which is another connection to the first film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. No, you're right. You're absolutely right. That was a problem with the first film for a lot of people. I never had that problem, but it was also like...
Oh, I didn't have the problem. I just, yeah, it's really convoluted.
Like, what's there to explain? It's like,
yeah.
You know, he's hanging off the ceiling. That's all you need to know. Like...
Yeah.
That's kind of what the movies are going for. I mean, that's also true of De Palma in general. You know, if you sit down and outline his plots, they sound completely ridiculous. But but while you're watching, it's just like, you know, he's got you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That's true of a lot of the directors they've gotten for these movies. I mean, it's true of John Woo, even though, you know, I don't think Mission Impossible 2 works all that well. But like, John Woo is the king of like, don't worry too much about like the overall story. Like, here's, and he also is very much comes from the school of like, I interviewed him a couple of months ago, and you know, his whole thing with Hard Boiled was like, we didn't know what it was going to be. And we shot these scenes without knowing how they were going to come together. That actually sounds like how they make some of these Mission Impossible movies, especially in the Macquarie era. Mm-hmm. I mean, the story he tells about how he came on to Ghost Protocol and like rewrote all this stuff. And one of the things they were doing was like, the thing he said to them, I guess, was, here's your problem. You're trying to write Tom Cruise out of the Mission Impossible movies. Like, he should be the hero of this movie. Like, what are you doing? Mm. They do kind of do a lot of that rewriting. In fact, last time, you know, when I was rewatching Fallout, I caught more of those scenes where it's like some establishing shot of, you know, a character like walking towards another character, and there's all this dialogue, and you can clearly tell it was ADR'd in later, and it's all exposition, and it's all just like,
right,
they've got to explain something here so that we know like why they're jumping out of this plane, you know. But yeah, it doesn't really matter. Like, they jumped out of the plane. Like, you're watching them jump out of the plane. It doesn't really matter why they did it at that point, as long as the action on screen is authentic and exciting and grabs your attention. You don't really care why they're doing it. You start to wonder why they're doing it if it just looks ridiculous, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I did say this in my review, that like, Dead Reckoning seems to care a bit more about its plot. Like, it explains it a lot more directly. And like, the whole thing with the entity, like, they really care about this entity, which I think is leading to an interesting place. And I sort of see it. Like, I sort of see you know, the metaphorical quality of it. And there was a little bit of that in Top Gun Maverick, too.
Totally.
Which, by the way, we should talk a little bit about Top Gun Maverick, because that movie also, along with Fallout, sets such a high standards. I mean, that movie is just incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. That was my number one movie for last year.
Yeah, and that was my number two movie, and people laughed at me. I was like, what are you talking about? This is so much better than any of the shit you people put on your list. But, you know, talk about a filmmaker who understands lyricism. I mean, Joseph Kosinski is sometimes that's all he does. And he was such a perfect director for that material.
Mm-hmm.
The collision of McQuarrie's almost engineer-like sensibilities in terms of plot construction and scene construction
mm-hmm.
with Kosinski's lyricism and just the ability he has to give weight to even just like the most offhand moments, that created something incredible. Again, I love Dead Reckoning, but it's coming on the heels of Fallout and Top Gun Maverick. So it's like,
totally,
maybe not as good as they are, but that's okay.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, no, you're right. The bar was in the sky.
I am wondering what I'll think, because Veronica was talking about a movie this morning recently that she watched that she didn't like at all. And I won't say because it'll excite you too much. But now she does like it a lot on her second view. I just wonder if time might do some more, and also having the second part. I mean, Kill Bill 2 is very different than Kill Bill.
Yeah.
And that's something. I mean, Kill Bill 2 and Kill Bill 1, I mean, you guys are younger than me, so, but like, I remember...
Oh, I remember it was supposed to be one big movie. Yeah, I talked with Tarantino about that back. He's very excited.
It was supposed to be one big movie, but I remember also when Kill Bill 1 came out, a lot of people were disappointed in it. Like, I remember a lot of people were just like, oh, you know, it doesn't make any sense.
Knives Out.
And then Kill Bill 2 came out. Some people were like, now it makes sense. Other people were like, no, this is the good one. The first one was kind of a mess.
Yeah.
And now it's funny because I think Kill Bill 1's reputation is probably better than Kill Bill 2's.
I'm sure TikTok likes it more. Yeah,
yeah, probably.
It's got more of those memeable moments. But yeah, no, 2 is the adult. I like 2 better.
I mean, I love how he split it into 2, and the tonally the two films are different. You know,
yeah, exactly.
It would be really interesting to see like a pretty big tonal distinction with part 2.
I would love that. I don't think they're going to do it, but I would love it.
I would love it too. I mean, one thing that I think makes me a little bit skeptical of like whether that's possible or I guess like how they would do it exactly is the death of Ilse Faust, which I would love to talk about.
Yeah, terrible decision.
Someone recently said to me like, well, Rebecca Ferguson wanted out, and I actually don't know anything about it on the industrial side.
Oh,
but
I didn't hear that.
Whether that might be like the motivation for her elimination from the franchise, but it makes like a really, really big difference. And I think one of the things that I noticed about Dead Reckoning was, yeah, just what felt like a very facile substitution of Hayley Atwell's character for Ilse Faust. And it just feels like a bummer because Ilse Faust is so capable. She's so good at doing stuff. She's so good at like vehicles and combat. And then Grace, fantastic thief, I imagine, but just doesn't sort of seem like she has the same kind of chops on screen in a spy thriller. And it, I don't know, it just felt like a bad trade to use a sports metaphor, I guess.
Yeah, I'd rather have Rebecca Ferguson in the second one than.
Yeah, what are they doing?
I liked Grace, I have to say. I liked Hayley Atwell a lot. I mean, very different character, obviously, than Ilse Faust.
Mm-hmm.
I was really shocked at Ilse Faust's death. I did not want to believe it.
I still don't. I think it's fake.
Me
somehow.
Too.
I've had some confirmation that it's not fake, but they rewrite these things all the time, so you never know.
Yeah, the entity could revive her for their own purposes.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. What I love about Ilse Faust is she's, yes, very capable, ass-kicking, you know, can kill anything in sight. But also, she's always so vulnerable because of kind of the situation that she's in. I mean, her narrative situation is she's always been targeted. She's on the outs. She wants to come home. She's always felt so vulnerable in that sense. In some ways, that's why I actually found it shocking that they killed her, because it's never the really vulnerable characters that die in these movies.
I mean,
these types of movies. In some ways, it's kind of a bold choice to kill her. At the same time, it does make you wonder, oh, God, like, what are we going to do without her in this series?
Bring Jeremy Renner back.
Bring back John Lark. They had great chemistry. He's a big-eyed brunette.
It's true. It's true. Queer the franchise.
But they killed her. Did make me think, like, I didn't believe it at first. I thought, oh, I'm going to find a way to bring her back. I think it's clear that they're going to bring Pom Klementieff back in a much bigger role, I think.
Oh, really?
Mm.
Well, because at the end, they're like, oh, we got a pulse.
Oh, I didn't.
And there's so little of her. I mean, she's a scene stealer, but there's relatively little of her that.
Absolutely.
I have this idea that she's probably going to be kind of part of the team in the next one, you know?
Mm. Yeah.
Which could be interesting. I thought about Ilse Faust's death and thought, okay, I feel like they're probably setting something up for the second movie with this. Because if she wanted out, they could have killed her in part two. I mean, they're kind of shooting these back to back. But who knows?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see. You know, McQuarrie is a very smart guy. And I think he's a very, very good filmmaker on so many levels. So
I do too.
I have a lot of trust in him. But again, I like the movie a lot. So it's not, you know, for me, it's just like, oh, it's a great movie and looking forward to the sequel. But I also think that he's very responsive to certain things, not like audiences complaining or anything like that. But I do think that he has a good understanding of when he sees something, he knows where the sort of pressure points are. And he knows what he can change and how he can play around with these ideas. So I'm looking forward to it. Mm. We'll see, obviously.
Yeah.
Do you have any other like predictions or wish list items for part two?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, gosh. You know, it's funny. I don't even usually think in those terms. Like, I try not to think about, you know, what's going to be in the sequel.
Yeah.
But, you know, when they make them part one, part two like that, you do wonder. The other thing I was wondering about, though, was I can't remember when they announced that they were going to be two parts.
Mm.
But I do wonder if it was a case of we've got so much stuff and we're going to make two movies, or it was we're making this one and then we realized we should make another one. You know, like I don't know what the thinking was there.
I would tell you on Wikipedia anyway, January 2019, Cruise announced that the 7th and 8th Mission Impossible films would be shot back to back with McQuarrie writing directable. So it sounds like it was announced all at once. It's all come out at the same
time. Okay, so it was conceived as such. So that's interesting.
Yeah.
Which suggests that they have a plan for it and it's not just going to be set piece, you know, but who knows?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and he does end that little Paramount promotional thing on the bike stunt, or maybe it was the train one. On one of those things, he says, "This is the scariest thing I've ever had Tom Cruise do until next time."
Yeah, he does say something like this.
Until part eight, something like that. And that could just be showmanship, or it could be like, oh, what do they got next time?
Well, I do remember him saying something, and it's really stuck with me because it didn't sound like promo BS. Like he was like, he did something even crazier in the next one, which I was curious. I was like, oh, has he already done it, or is there still a chance he might die? You know, like that's the thing. My mind immediately goes to like, what's going
to
happen?
Yeah, but without trying to predict the second one, like I'm more interested too in what happens to this franchise. Does it stop when Cruise stops, or do they James Bond it?
Yeah,
or,
that's what I was wondering,
you know,
too.
Because I thought forever that they were trying to bring Jeremy Renner slowly along, and then after like three films, he's like, this guy's never going to stop. I got to get out of this franchise. You know?
Yeah,
I've really been wondering about that because, you know, the John Wick movies provide an interesting example of one way of doing it. I mean, the John Wick movies are a little different in that they really, really depend entirely on Keanu Reeves's charisma, like completely.
Mm-hmm.
And even the set pieces are just his fighting, his stunts. They're not like elaborate set pieces. It's just like a bunch of people killing each other. And, you know, and I think they just premiered, like, is it the trailer for the mini series, you know, for the Continental that they have, like something like that.
Oh,
either the poster or the trailer, something, you know, the mini series. And then they've got this Len Wiseman, you know, Ana de Armas ballerina thing. I'm just like,
no,
oh my God, what is happening? Like, like who wants to watch this? Now, it does make you wonder, though. One, obviously, the stars age, can't have them doing this thing into their 70s.
Unless it's Liam Neeson, I guess. But yeah.
And I love Liam Neeson. Like
I love Liam Neeson too.
I will watch anything with Liam Neeson in it.
Me too. Are you in a tight spot, Liam Neeson? I want to see it happen.
Have you seen the new one? The new one. It's Liam Neeson stuck in a car. Literally.
Like, I haven't seen it.
I can't wait to see it. It's coming out in August.
That's not Ferrari, right?
It's not Ferrari. No,
no, it's not.
No, I know. I was making a man joke.
So, I mean, John Wick has gone in one direction, and it did make me wonder if they have this idea that Mission Impossible can go in that direction as well. you know, or it could go in another direction where it's like, you know, he's still around, but, you know, he's maybe takes a step back or maybe comes in for one step. I don't know.
Miles Teller jumps in there. Yeah.
Oh,
it's such an interesting conundrum. Okay. And part of it has to do with the way Hollywood does business is that, you know, they have these franchises that have to go on and on and on and on.
Yeah.
And like, why are we even wondering what's going to happen to the Mission Impossible? Like, that's so not our,
right.
Like, we should just enjoy the movies or not enjoy them.
They're going to leave it up to us.
No, I know. That's the thing. It's a weird situation to be in. Like, I do care about it, but I'm wondering also, like, I have to like step back and wonder why I care about this. Like, I want the movies to be good. I want to enjoy them.
Yeah.
And in 10 years, Tom Cruise should be doing whatever the hell he wants to do and making other movies.
Yeah.
I think Hollywood is also aware that they can't keep sort of spending endless amounts of money on these things. So there's probably a certain point at which they've realized, well, let's scale these back. Let's spend less money on them. But the thing about spending less money is also you're probably going to make less money. And that's okay.
Yeah.
But they can't ever say that. You know, they can't ever say, well, you know, we're done with Keanu. We're just going to spend less money on these things. We're going to have a bunch of miniseries. I mean, they do say, oh, yeah, we're going to take advantage of all these opportunities across all our platforms. And they give all this sort of corporate speak. What that's really saying is, it's going to cost less. There's going to be more of it. You might not love it all. It might not make as much money, but it's going to turn a bigger profit because of all these other ancillaries and whatnot. I mean, Mission Impossible started off as a TV series. Maybe they just turn it back into a TV series. And it's like, I'm also convinced the White Widow is going to play a bigger part in the next one. Like, what if it's the White Widow and Hayley Atwell and... You know,
yeah, the Birds of Prey version.
On Pom Clemente. Yeah. I mean, what if this is just like the three of them taking on, you know, I'd watch that. I don't know that it'd be as good as Fallout, but what is?
Yeah.
What is? But and the last thing I would say, too, that with Dead Reckoning, the bad guy didn't do it for me. Like, I just thought that the Unabomber-ish, you know, head of the syndicate guy, he freaked me out every time he was just in a scene. I was worried.
Solomon
like,
Lane,
what crazy shit is he going to do?
Yeah.
And he was sadistic. He was clearly, you know, psychopathic. It had no qualms about doing anything at any time. Gabriel didn't give me any of that same vibe. And also the entity, I spent half the movie trying to figure out what it was or what it is. I couldn't tell anybody what it was. It's bad. You don't want it around your stuff. But it just seems like it's just going to, like, when I wonder about part two, I'm like, well, how are they going? Because he's always had a real villain to fight against. Like, and there wasn't, there didn't seem to be the counterpoint that was as terrifying and, like, batshit crazy as both Henry Cavill and Sean Harris.
Yeah, seriously. When he has the beard, I always think he's the guy from all the Neil Blomkamp movies.
Oh, yeah.
I always thought it was him. I like the entity. I will say...
The name is terrible.
I feel like there was a bit of a missed opportunity. They've set up the entity as being totally all powerful, especially because there's so much technology used in these films. But I did wonder, like, there's that great little moment when, like, Kittredge is at headquarters and it's just like, all right, we're using this like old decommissioned satellite and it's just all analog screens. And I thought, oh, this is great. Mm-hmm. This is a great idea. It's just to force them into this situation with,
They
have to go all analog. And that's the kind of the way they've set up. And then the next
thing,
that
would be cool.
And then, well, that's what they say they're going to do. And the next thing I know, you know, Benji's got a self-driving car. And I was like, wait, this doesn't, like, I feel like the entity could probably kill him right now, you know?
Yeah.
I want them to do more with it. I hope they do more with it in part two. Like, they've set the entity up as something all powerful. And yet, it doesn't seem all that powerful, or it doesn't seem to be able to control all the things that it should be able to control. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Part of that could just be like, listen, it's a Mission Impossible movie. We are here for the stunts. We're not going to spend that much time setting all this crap up. But I would love it if they did.
Yeah.
That is precisely my hope, that they'll kind of refine whatever this kind of digital versus analog tech skeptical attitude is. Because I mean, to me, there's such an interesting and obvious tension between that let's revert back to the analog technology, which I also loved and would love to see more of. Like, I want to see tapes catching fire in the next one and like the little smoke cloud and everything. And this being the first film that's shot on digital. So it's like a tick in the other column somehow. And then also they're so insistent, especially in that pre-film featurette, about the use of like real stunt work, real effects, even though obviously it's amplified with all kinds of computer generated imagery. But I don't know, just like that seems to be really interesting, where like the film plot and this kind of extra filmic context is both invested in the relationship between the real or the analog and the digital, mm-hmm. and this kind of pervasive, like hackable evil. And to have all of that, everything in Dead Reckoning going on, like to have that happening and then also have it begin the way it begins while the submersible news is still like heavy on the mind and then all the AI discourse, like it just feels
yeah.
like this whole like Tom Cruise playing himself reality reference situation is more complicated than maybe even like the filmmakers realize yet. But I'm hoping that it'll get untangled or further tangled a little bit in the next one. I think we should probably wrap up, yeah?
Yeah, we're good.
Well, last call. Typically, we end every episode asking our guests to share a quick staff recommendation. Bilgo, we'd love to hear one from you.
When you say staff recommendation, is it like just anything?
Like you're working in a video store and I'm asking you to recommend something to me.
All right, okay.
Metaphorical staff.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
I never knew that either until just...
Oh, really? I mean...
Now it makes way more sense.
Oh, you don't know about my invisible video store that I'm imagining everyone works in? I'm just thinking about like the index cards and stuff.
Yeah. No, I used to write those at Scarecrow all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay. They're still up 20-some years later. I'm very proud of them.
All right.
I rewatched this film recently and I've always loved it, but it's one of those movies where when you watch it, you think to yourself, wait, is this the best movie ever made? You know, and... It's Michael Mann's Manhunter, which is not even the fifth best movie Michael Mann has made, and yet somehow is the greatest movie ever made. As I call this, this is my like quantum paradox of Michael Mann. Any movie he's made is like the best movie ever made, but somehow not even like fourth on the list. But I rewatched it recently, the director's cut version. We were just talking about lyricism in action thrillers. I mean, there is a movie that's incredibly lyrical, where the villain is incredibly compelling, where the relationship between the villain and the hero is fascinating and complicated and disturbing. Mm-hmm. And of course, these are all probably reasons why the movie was like a flop when it came out. But since then, it's, you know, it's a classic. Anyway, I was watching it again and just reminded all over again how beautiful it was. And that's the film I would recommend.
I love that. Yeah. As you were talking about, like, why do we care what happens to the Mission Impossible sort of franchise, even as we can certainly trust that it will either keep going or not? And what does it matter? I was just thinking about like my own overinvestment in Heat 2 and how like it like does not matter at all, like for anybody what happens with that. It's not a franchise, but with that sort of continuation. And yet, like, I get so wrapped up in late night moments and like fan casting and what people think is going to happen with it. Because
are they making a movie? You know, I just know he did the book.
He wants to. Yeah.
Yeah. I think
he's planning on it.
Yeah. He wants. Wow. Well, yeah, okay. He wants to. Yeah. Get going, Michael Mann. You know, but
well, he's got a new movie coming out finally this year. Should be premiering at Venice. Will also be at New York Film Festival, opens in December. Yeah. Ferrari, which is a film he's wanted to make for a long time. It looks like it'll be successful, and you know, hopefully that combined with just the clout of the fact that he's Michael Mann and people are really fascinated by Heat. I would love to see him make Heat 2. I thought the novel was wonderful and I mean, dense and complex, and part of me wondered, wow, I feel like there's more than one movie in here if he wants to make another one, but who knows?
You could do Heat 2 part 1.
Heat 2 part 2.
Yeah. Cool. Well, man, it was so great to have you on the show. You know, we drew up a list a year or two ago of people that are just dream guests, and you were near the top of that list. And so we're waiting for the right time to be able to talk about something in your wheelhouse. I mean, spoiler
clearly
alert,
it's a big wheelhouse.
I was gonna say everything's kind of in your wheelhouse. To be fair,
this is good. Now I'm happy to talk about this.
But yeah, it was just great to hear you talk about those films. And we certainly encourage people to look up, just Google his name and Mission Impossible and see all the articles that come up and just read them all. They're great. The prep work was very, very fun this time around.
Yeah, it's such an honor. Thank you so much for joining us.
And for supporting Brightwall Dark Room for so long. You were an early supporter, and we appreciate that so much.
Oh, cool. Was I an early supporter? I mean, I've been supporting it. It's just I never know when I join on these things how long something's been around.
Well, I will tell you, because I looked it up since you donate through the Patreon thing. It keeps track of when you started. So of all the people that donated at the same time as you, you're the only one that's left that's still
donating. Everybody else left.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's been a while. Sure. I mean, to be fair, it was 2015, but I mean, that's
the last patron standing. Oh,
wow. That's an incredible amount of support to offer a little site like ours for 8 years. So
you guys did great work, really. Yeah. So
thank you so much. And I remember you retweeting stuff on the Hitchcock issue, which was at least 6 or 7 years ago now. So yes, just thank you for everything, for the support, and thank you for all the work you do, which makes all of our lives better to read. So
thank you.
Really, really great to have you on here.
Yeah. So Bilgo, where can we find you online?
You know, just about everything I write these days is for Vulture. Occasionally I write other things, but that's, you know, Vulture, New York Magazine, vulture.com. That's where to find me.
Sure. Fantastic. And plenty present on X. This is the first time I've called it.
Don't say that. Sorry. Yeah, I don't want to say that.
I know. It's awful. And now tweets are posts. They're officially reposts.
No, we don't have to say that.
Okay. That's fair. I'll let the entity sort it out. And just a quick heads up and reminder, we actually do have our very first live event scheduled with Gallery. Veronica and I will be talking about the film Daisies from Mike Mills' List on Gallery's platform on Friday, August 25th at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So if you're hearing this, we'd love to have you come out and join us. You can use the promo code that we're going to link to in the show notes and get in some early access on Gallery. Come discuss the movie with us. We're going to try to make it fun and interactive, and we'd love to pack the room with Bright Wall listeners so that it's a really fun and ribald conversation. See you soon.
To read this month's issue, visit us at brightwalldarkroom.com. You can also find us on Twitter at BWDR and at the BWDR podcast.
And just a reminder, if you enjoyed what you heard today, please consider subscribing, sharing, rating, reviewing the show, anything you can to help us spread the word about our little corner of the podcasting world.
This episode is sponsored by Gallery, a new kind of film club. Listeners can sign up at join.gallery.com/BWDR. Our theme music is composed by Chad Perman. This podcast is produced and edited by Eli Sands.
Bye.
Bye.
Let's wrap Bilga so that he can redeem his ticket to board the good ship Demeter for its last voyage.
Nice.
One-way cruise.
Nice.
Oh no, what happens to the Demeter? what haven't they told me?
Oh my God.